NPR will discontinue its comment section on NPR.org next week. Instead, it wants listeners to comment on social media, Facebook or Twitter. NPR isn't the first news outlet to do this. It joins a growing number of newspapers and other news organizations who have pulled the plug on website comments or who have restricted them. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8.5 minutes past 7 o'clock on this Friday, August 19th. We'll talk about why and how this affects our public discourse on issues. And we'll also wonder how we can make our online discussions more civil or more productive. What do you think? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk at WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Let me welcome our guest. Happy to have with us Dietram Scheufele, a professor of life sciences communication at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy.
So NPR just made this announcement of what are your thoughts and what's your reaction to NPR, National Public Radio, ending its online comments on NPR.org?
Yeah, I saw the announcement yesterday, and it was probably one of the more carefully written announcements that really went through all the different arguments for and against. And I think I thought it was very carefully weighted, and it's certainly consistent with the evidence that's out there for why that's a good idea sometimes and why it may be an even better idea to move it to social media and other platforms.
Yeah, so why is it a good idea sometimes?
I think the idea, and I think the piece on NPR.org referred to that. There was a lot of excitement when the internet first grew up, if you will, about having a whole new platform for a whole new type of discussion among citizens. It would connect us all into one big global debate, and in many ways in line with what the founding fathers had thought about, right? And so I think that normatively from what should be that was a really exciting thing. Empirically, meaning from what really happened, that unfortunately didn't play out that way at all. There were trolls. It required heavy moderating, and I think everybody ran into the exact same problems.
Yeah, in fact, NPR was saying in part that they were devoting a lot of resources to monitoring these discussions when a small percentage of people were actually, compared to listeners, were actually using the service.
I think that's part of it, that a small number of people, and I think other media organizations globally actually found the exact same phenomenon. But you also have a very small number of people, of those people who are using it in ways that really make it less than pleasant for everybody else, meaning who troll other people, who insult them, and who destroy that discourse that we were so hopeful about in the beginning.
Yeah, what's the deal with this? What is a troll?
A troll is basically a person who attacks other people, who engages in ad hominem insults, largely to get a reaction from people, largely to basically get the discussions to go off the rails and really turn into just big mutt fights or mutt slinging.
Yeah.
And ultimately, you know, the only point is to start a fight and is not to have a reasonable argument.
Yeah, so are trolls just doing this because they have nothing better to do, or are they paid for this, or what's the deal with that?
There's actually both. I mean, there are certainly people who just do this maybe because they have nothing better to do, or maybe they just have the personality of someone who really likes to upset other people, and neither one is necessarily a very good interpretation, right? But there's also, as you said, there are sometimes efforts by organizations, sometimes by countries, and there have certainly been accusations that Russia, for instance, has engaged in this, to derail the discourse on certain topics, to make sure that there is not a reasonable expression of public opinion because they want one particular outcome and they want to discredit a particular viewpoint. So it can be used both strategically by groups, and we've seen it, but probably the one that most of us have at some point encountered, if we've looked at comment sections, are individuals who just really get some pleasure for whatever reason out of attacking other people and seeing the debates on these online forums just going south.
Yeah. So NPR, like other news outlets that have done this in the past, said let's move the discussion over to social media. Is that a good alternative?
In many ways it is, right? Because on the one hand, of course, social media have been created for exactly that purpose and have mechanisms built in that create accountability. And I think that's a really important part, that idea of social accountability. So if I go to Facebook, I have to sign in with at least some form of a public profile. Same thing for Twitter, same thing for Google Plus, depending on how prominent that still is as a platform. But there is both in terms of what these platforms are made to be, meaning they are platforms for debate, but also in terms of that social accountability. I think it's a good idea. It's also, and I think that's a really important part, mass media or traditional media were never created as a platform for broad debates. They were created to disseminate high-quality information that's been collected by professionals, that's been curated by professionals, to audiences that either through taxpayer money or through a commercial model are willing to pay for it. But they were never designed to actually, you know, host that kind of discourse. So I think that's an important point to make as well.
Yeah. And NPR's ombudsperson who wrote the piece about the announcement noted in that article, I believe, that one drawback is that on social media, only maybe half of the stories, not even half of the stories, are posted on social media as are posted on NPR.org. So we're not necessarily commenting on all that's out there.
Yeah, and that is a big drawback, and that's one of the big drawbacks, that certainly there's some form of pre-selection of what ends up making it through. Some media organizations, of course, have tried to work around that. We saw the New York Times trying to come to an agreement, or actually coming to an agreement with Facebook on distributing their articles through Facebook as a medium, as a new distribution channel, rather than people going to NewYorkTimes.com or whatever else. But the second problem that I think we see in social media, and Twitter does this now as well, is that they order and place prominence on stories based on their algorithms. So that means that if I'm particularly interested in a type of story, or if my friends even that I have on Facebook or the people that I follow on Twitter are particularly interested, then it's much more likely that I see the story. What does that mean in the long run? It means that I'm much more likely to see again and again what I already believe in, what I'm already interested in, and I'm much less likely to see what I may be not that interested in or what I haven't looked at before. But that may be actually the important part for me to know, right? Because that's what I know the least about. And so some people have talked about this as filter bubbles or echo chambers. So the idea that we live in a bubble that filters information for us, or an echo chamber where we only hear what we already know. And I think that's, especially on social media, that's a real problem. And it's, of course, something that, you know, that we wouldn't have or we don't have on an NPR.org or on a curated newspaper website or whatever else.
Right. Yeah, I know. I'm frustrated sometimes as the person who often posts stories on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page, and I want to promote that we're talking about an issue. I want to solicit some comments on an issue before we actually do the show. We'll see that there, you know, like two people have seen this so far. I mean, and then Facebook mm-hmm. will say, would you like to pay to boost this post? So
yeah.
it doesn't get to everybody that I want it to get to.
Yeah, and it's important to realize, right, Facebook is not a tool for information dissemination. It's a tool actually for information collection, meaning the product are the users. That's what Facebook makes money off of. So Facebook makes money off of collecting data from the different readers. So it's not necessarily interested in promoting particular information. It's not necessarily interested in making sure that a profile is being seen, unless that translates into monetary value. Now, that's not a bad thing. That's not, you know, to condemn Facebook's business model in any way, but it is an important limitation of the platform, because unless it makes money, unless people see what they're really interested in, and unless they stay there, Facebook is not gonna make a profit, and so their behavior is just consistent with that.
You know, we have just a minute before a news break, but NPR certainly isn't the first news organization to do this. It seems as though Reuters, The Verge, all sorts of, in fact, Cap Times last year in Madison, and the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel restricted online comments. I mean, do you see the day coming when these online comment sections on the website are new of news outlets are just going to go away?
I very much think so. I think they're going to be the exception rather than the rule, and maybe they go away altogether and really shift over to social media. I'd be very surprised if that didn't happen.
Yeah. Well, we'll talk more about the implications of this and whether you think it's a good thing or a bad thing. And we'll talk more about how we can make our online discussions, even on social media, a little more productive and or a little more civil. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. NPR announced this week it's going to discontinue the comment section on news stories on NPR.org, and it joins a growing number of media outlets that are eliminating or restricting their online comments feature. Do you think this is a good idea or not? I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are talking about NPR's decision announced this week that it will be eliminating the online comments section on NPR.org. And we're wondering what you think about that decision. How do you feel about NPR removing its comment section? They're trying to move discussions over to social media. Do you comment online on news organization websites? Are you more of someone who comments on Facebook or Twitter? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. What do you like or what don't you like about online discussions? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. We are talking about this trend and why it's happening with Dietram Scheufele, who is a professor of life sciences communication at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Mike on Facebook says, I was upset when I read this until I realized that I only commented on Facebook in the past. The trolls, hate, and vitriol are just an element of social media that is best left ignored. Well, that brings up a couple of things. So, at first, Mike was mad about this, and then he said, wait a minute, I don't comment online anyway. So give us an idea, if you can, Dietram, about whether, I mean, most people do comment on Facebook or Twitter and not so much on websites.
Yeah, there's definitely a much higher proportion of folks who engage with others on political issues or whatever else on Facebook or on Twitter than in comment sections. And there's even a difference, obviously, between Twitter, where you can follow people fairly easily and where the networks are much more widely distributed, than on Facebook, where most of us, I think, have probably narrower sets of friends and very often people that we do at least know face-to-face. And so we're then the conversations become even more more aware of our social environment.
Yeah, and as we mentioned, NPR said it was making this move in part because of the resources devoted to monitor the website and the comparatively few people who were actually using the website to comment. But they also, as you mentioned, said that the comments section was mainly being used as a forum to duke it out with one another.
Yeah,
people, though, can duke it out in comments on Facebook, too, can't they?
Yeah, they could, there's at least one reason why they don't do it as often, and that is that in comment sections, I can give myself some random name, Elephant59 or whatever else that might be, and hide behind a cloak of anonymity. And that's a really, really important aspect psychologically. So if I have to do something in a way where people know that it's me, where I'm socially accountable, then I'm much less likely to do that than if I can do it anonymously. And social psychologists have long talked about this as us thinking about what they call the generalized other. So that is that little person in your head that tells you before you do something if that's a good or a bad idea. So most of us don't pick our nose, not because we're really afraid that when we do it, there's going to be some sanction, that our mom is there telling us we shouldn't do it, or that the person next to us will yell at us, But we actually don't do it because inside our head we're constantly self-censoring based on what one does and doesn't do. And so the same thing happens in conversations. When you and I talk and I say something that's outrageous or that really upsets you, I will be able to read that from your face. I will be able to read the nonverbal cues. And I will most likely respond to those because we've over thousands of years figured out how to navigate that without sometimes saying things and read our fears, our emotions, and so on. Online, none of that applies. And it doesn't apply in particular if I don't have to give my identity, if I can just anonymously go in and basically destroy a conversation. And so that's why it's so much more difficult to engage in that kind of behavior in Facebook when everybody knows who I am, when everybody can look at my profile, and so on, than it is to do that in an anonymous setting in a comment section.
You know, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel earlier this year, I'm trying to remember exactly what they did, they did not eliminate their comment section, but they required, I think, only subscribers to the paper could participate. I don't know if they required real names being used. Do you know how that's going?
I honestly don't know how well that's going. It's certainly half of the solution or part of the solution. The other part being moderation. So if somebody still posts something that's maybe inappropriate, maybe racist, that may be hurtful, you still need to moderate it out. The problem with moderation that a lot of news organizations have complained about, and rightfully so, is that it is unbelievably expensive because you have to do it 24/7. A lot of these conversations taking place at night and, you know, spiraling out of control, well, by the time the morning rolls around, you already have basically the damage done. So unless you really do this 24/7 and devote the resources to that, that's really difficult to do. And to do that in an environment where we're having thinner and thinner profit margins, if any, in the news industry, I think that's that's an unrealistic expectation.
Well, we have lots of comments. So let's go to the phones. Chris in Wisconsin Dells is with us. Hi, Chris.
Happy rainy day.
Yeah, it is rainy.
That's okay. The corn is coming in, and the farmers need it, and that's good.
Right.
My garden needs it. I have been paying attention to your website and to Kathleen's, and mostly this has to do with what happened in Milwaukee and with the Donald Trump fiasco. And there are just a couple of people that are sniping at other people, and they're calling them names, and they just write one nasty sentence. And it's not useful because it's happened to me, and I went back into the website and explained myself to this person. And then I was thinking about that, and I thought, you know what? These people are getting off on goading people into responding. And if you're being called names or somebody is making a cynical or sarcastic remark to you, it's not useful to go back at them because they're just adolescent ignoramuses, and they're getting off.
Let me clarify too with Chris, and I'm glad you use our Facebook pages, but we do not have. You're talking about Facebook, not website comments.
Yeah,
right?
I'm talking about the Facebook page.
Yeah.
But I'm just recommending to people that if they are being sniped at by these couple of people, and it's the same couple of people that are doing it, is just leave them alone to fester in their own venom because they're having a hoot that it's making you angry.
Yeah, we do have a little bit of that going on. Maybe some would say a lot of that going on some of our Facebook discussions. Dietram, I guess, do you have any general thoughts on
sure.
on how one might? You see the comments sometimes don't feed the trolls. How do you deal with that if there's somebody sniping at you on a Facebook discussion?
Yeah, and I certainly would echo Chris's comment here. Trolling only works if there's a response, and so simply not responding very often is a very good response. As Chris said, let them fester in their own venom. I do think that it also depends on what issue we're talking about, and certainly the election came up. And I think it's good to look at some of the statistics because this is an election that is probably one of the more divisive elections that we've seen. If you look at the latest Pew surveys, they actually report that now we have about a quarter to a third of registered Republicans and registered Democrats. So on both sides, that's a phenomenon, thinking that the other side is terrible for the country and is actually out to destroy the country. Or has policies that would potentially destroy the country. So we're as polarized as a people as we've ever been. And the two sides are really far apart. So it doesn't take much to really start discussions that can get out of control. And I think a little bit of restraint from all of us, because it's not just trolls in that context. I think we're going into an election where, you know, every side feels very strongly that the other side is potentially horrible, and so I think there's that thing is ready to blow. So in the sense that we get into needless and maybe too fierce a battle in some of these online conversations, and I would certainly urge us all to be reasonable and to think that and to really think through the arguments on both sides rather than just engage in fights online.
Let's go next to Nate in Stevens Point. Hi, Nate.
Hey, great topic. Hey, I've noticed that comment sections are kind of disappearing on websites, but I haven't really heard it addressed yet. Anyway, I think that the comment sections really add value to the stories. You know, you don't have to go to a third-party website to discuss the topic, the story. You know, I don't have a Twitter account. I barely use Facebook. I just think it's convenient to be able to comment.
Yeah, and I'm sure your phone is breaking up, Nate. So you have, that's what we're talking about. But yeah, we broadened our discussion a little bit. He says he likes the website comment sections because he doesn't have a Twitter account. He doesn't use Facebook. And so what's he supposed to do now?
Well, first of all, I mean, in many ways, a Twitter or Facebook account are easy enough to get, and depending on what your personal preferences are, that they're really good ways of interacting. But there are also others, and I think Reddit, for instance, is a really good website that has, from the very beginning, been built on the idea of interactions of people. Not just commenting, but doing it in a very, very heavily moderated environment, but also in one where you democratize basically the rating of comments. So where comments are upvoted, downvoted, and where ultimately the discourse hopefully is elevated around particular topics. So Reddit is, I think, another really good platform that doesn't require, you to sign up with one of the big social media firms. But having said this, of course, there's a huge irony in Reddit, and that is when they created their own news website called Upworthy, they actually opened Upworthy without allowing any reader comments. So even Reddit, you know, the OOR kind of discussion website ended up banning reader comments when they created their own news website.
Yeah. Thanks, Nate, for the call. We are talking about the decision announced this week by NPR that it is ending its online comments section on news stories on NPR.org. It is telling listeners to bring the discussion to social media like Facebook and Twitter. What do you think of this decision? What do you think of this trend? NPR is not the only news organization to do this. In fact, our guest says that probably very soon there won't be website online comment sections, that this discussion is going to be mostly on social media sites. Do you think this is a good trend, a bad trend? Do you comment on social media or on websites? 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Dietram Scheufele is our guest. He's a professor of life sciences communication at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Our next caller is Melinda in Green Bay. Hello, Melinda.
Hi, Joy. Good morning. I think it's sad that these comments have to be removed from the website. I have participated in the past commenting, thinking that there would be a thoughtful discussion of a topic it could be controversial or not, but it's been rather shocking to me how quickly things deteriorate into just a vulgar exchange of opinions that are, I think, purely emotionally based. And why everybody wants to get into a fight is kind of surprising. So I've pulled away from commenting, I think it's probably a decision that had to be made, and it's unfortunate because NPR does a lot of great stories, and sometimes it's great just to send kudos or give a positive response, but now it's going to be, we just don't have those options anymore with the way it seems that these comment options have deteriorated.
Yeah. And more further thoughts, Dietram, on why the comments are so nasty, aside from, you know, we're in an election year and we have a polarized electorate?
Yeah, and I mean, some of it has to do with the psychology of those participating, and I think, you know, Melinda makes an excellent point that people like her pulling out in many ways leave the field to the trolls. So, and I fully understand the reaction of saying, well, you know, I don't want to participate in that. That's just too vitriolic or whatever else for me. The downside to that, of course, is that leaves the playing field, if you will, even more to those folks who just use this for starting fights, for trolling and for whatever else. So there's a certain inbuilt kind of spiraling effect that's undesirable, but I think that's just unavoidable, because those of us who go there to have reasonable discussions will very quickly have the exact same experiences that Melinda's describing. And I think that's exactly why, from a Democratic perspective, news organizations also said, look, this is not giving our real readers, those who do want that discourse, what they need, so why maintain it, why put money into it, just to give somebody a playground to attack others.
Yeah. You know, but we have the experience at Wisconsin Public Radio, and I guess I'll just talk about the Drake Cardine Show. We have our Facebook page. We have a lot of good listeners who are contributing good comments and having good discussions, but there are a few who will just make really nasty comments, even very personal comments about other posters, you know, like where you know they looked at their profile even and will say, oh, how's that cushy state job and you know, and stuff like that. And so it's really creepy. It's almost like they're, you know, stalking or bullying you.
Yeah, and those are actually the ones that have the most negative effects, those ad hominem attacks on others. And in our research, so we test a lot of these things empirically. So we do large-scale surveys and then built in, so we have people read news stories, blog stories, and then we basically have them read user comments that we manipulate. And when I say manipulate, we kind of prepare different versions for different people. And so we, for example, did a study where one group randomly got these uncivil comments where people engaged in these ad hominem attacks and called other people names and so on, very much like you described. Excuse me. And then the other group got the exact same types of comments in the sense of making the same arguments, but they made them in a polite way without engaging in those attacks. And the outcomes were really troubling and astounding at the same time. What we found is that in the uncivil condition, people actually interpreted the article that had preceded the comments, and everybody read the exact same article, as more biased and as potentially less objective. So it actually has also, not only does it take a toll on those who are being attacked, which I think is really, really unfortunate and potentially traumatic for these folks, but it also takes a toll on perceptions of the quality of the news themselves, which of course is completely ridiculous, because in our study everybody read the exact same story. There was no difference, but still they looked at the story differently simply because people were yelling and screaming about it afterwards and attacking each other. So I think there are really negative impacts that A, affect those who participate in those discussions, but then also those who end up reading the article later and see those discussions and infer from them that there must be something wrong with the article. And of course, that's tremendously important for news organizations.
Yeah, and we have just a minute before a news break. So, for example, if a commenter is saying this is a biased story and this WPR is biased and this is ridiculous, that more people looking at that conversation will say, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, and it's not even that they say the story is biased. They're not even talking about the story itself. They're simply attacking other commenters. So simply by having an uncivil discussion, people later on make inferences that maybe the article itself has a problem, since the conversation is so out of hand.
Yeah, so it's in a news organization's best interest to not have that kind of uncivil discourse going on.
At the very least, there are very few arguments to present to journalists why they should have it if it undermines the perception of the quality of their work.
Yeah, well, you know what? We're going to talk a little bit more about that after we check news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. You can comment on the ending of comment sections on npr.org and other other news outlets on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. You can also tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. But we also invite your calls at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Talking about our online discussions with Dietram Scheufele, who is a professor of life sciences communications at UW-Madison. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking with our guest, Dietram Scheufele, a professor of life sciences communication at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, about online commenting. And NPR's decision announced this week that it will discontinue its comment section on NPR.org starting next week. Instead, it wants listeners to comment on stories on Facebook or Twitter, moving the discussion to social media. We're talking about why this is happening. It's a growing trend, news outlets discontinuing their website comment sections, and talking some on how we can make our online discussions more civil, more productive, and wondering what you think and whether you are a frequent commenter online or on social media. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Let's go to Jennifer in Waterford next. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
Some of my comments have been addressed, but I often find, I do not comment online, I find that people so often write what they do not have the courage to say to somebody's face. You also lack the feedback, and then so many sites, it turns out to be, and if I do look at the comments, it's three or four people, and the level of vitriol and personal sniping and personal attacks just to me is so distasteful and unnecessary, because there is no discussion. It's just people flashing insults back and forth without stopping to think what it is they're writing and sending. There's no 30-second pause button as to, you know, maybe I should just not say this. And like I said, the vitriol that exists online when you don't have to face someone, I find very discouraging and off-putting.
Yeah. So don't read the comments is a comment that you sometimes see, Dietram.
Yeah, and also I think Jennifer made that point. I think there are also a couple of comments on your Facebook page that talk about the same thing, that face-to-face interactions are so much more beneficial in certain ways than those online. And there's certainly research to suggest that is actually true, that some of those nonverbals, that feedback that Jennifer was talking about, that's really useful to help us navigate conversations in ways that are not insulting, not offensive, and not hurtful. But also our research, for instance, shows that in face-to-face discussions, especially with people that we disagree with, which is, after all, what this is all about, right? The idea of us exchanging ideas that are different and that we may not agree with, and then come up with the best possible solutions from them. The more we do that in face-to-face settings, we know from research, the more informed we are, the more efficacious we feel, meaning the better we feel about actually being able to make a difference in the political process, and ultimately the more participatory we are. So there is some real research that suggests that engaging in those face-to-face discussions, very much like the Founding Fathers intended, has positive outcomes. The hope, of course, is that eventually we'll figure out a way of broadening that and moving that to an online environment that has the same positive outcomes. At the moment, we're just not there yet, and I totally agree with Jennifer on that.
Thank you, Jennifer, for the call. I think Marcus in Milwaukee has a similar point. Hi, Marcus.
Hi, how are you today, Joy?
Good.
Okay. So I've noticed just in my personal life, and it includes even just texting between myself and my family and friends, whatever, but also with messages that are posted, quite often the mood of the person receiving it as they read the text, due to the fact that there's no inflection in the other person's voice, or there's no indications of the other person's intent, I feel that quite often comments are misinterpreted and taken wrong, which causes people to respond and sometimes say things that I don't think they would necessarily say if they had heard it verbally, or we're, you know, we're able to read the person's, you know, facial expressions, you know, because if you get, you know, like a wink at the end of a comment, you know that it's kind of a sarcastic comment or a joke. And online, there's none of that. And so the person who's reading it, their mood, you know, quite often, I feel, influences their response.
Yeah. And that's what your research shows, Dietram.
Yeah, and I think there's an interesting element to what Marcus said as well, and that is that the sender, of course, sometimes, even if I'm not trying to troll somebody or if I'm not trying to be offensive, all of us have probably sent an email and received an email, for that matter, that we misunderstood, where the sarcasm, where the irony, where the humor was lost on us, and that we interpreted in a particular way and either didn't respond or maybe responded in the wrong way. So I think that just highlights another element of how complex the online system is, because we don't have those cues, right? And there's this interesting linguistic study that looked at even putting a period after a text. So when I say thanks and I don't put a period versus thanks period, how that comes across very differently in terms of the sentiment that it communicates to the person receiving it. And I think that relates to a second point. That's why, you know, in Facebook, for instance, we now started to have a little bit more of an emotional reaction with those 5-6 different emoji that you can click on. It used to be that I post a story, for instance, you know, a really tragic story about maybe an accident, and that I think people need to know about, a news story, and all I could do is like it, which of course is the absolutely wrong emotion for that story. Now I can express a few more, but it basically just shows the limitations of the medium. It shows the limitations of a medium that doesn't reflect our emotions and what we really, and the subtleties of language very well, and we all have experienced situations where that just got out of hand, even in a non-malicious way for all of us.
Yeah. We talked a little bit about how Facebook and other social media conversations can be more civil because Facebook users are supposed to use their real names. But they don't always. They can create accounts that are some other name, and then you can try to block that account, and then the person shows up as another name. And so if somebody's really persistent and wants to be nasty on a Facebook page, it's pretty hard to monitor that, too.
It is, yeah. And Twitter, in many ways, has the same problem, or maybe even more so, since they have, you know, it's extremely easy to create bots, even, and that post automatically based on algorithms. What Twitter has introduced somewhat recently is that you can basically curate your feed and what you read and what you engage in based on verified accounts. So these are these accounts that used to be reserved for celebrities that have a little blue check mark next to them. And so you know that they're verified accounts, and you can basically curate your newsfeed. That has become more useful now that basically everybody can verify their account. So there's a process on Twitter that you can go through. You have to provide your personal websites and a bunch of other things, and then Twitter staff will actually verify you. And so that, I think, is a step in the right direction, because, of course, they realize and I think one or two of the commenters on your Facebook site right now commented on the same thing, that, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean that just because it's on Facebook or Twitter that people can't hide behind that cloak of anonymity. They still can. It's more difficult. But Twitter and some others are beginning to realize that that's a problem and are beginning to try and find creative solutions for them.
Yeah. John in Eau Claire wonders if you, Dietram, can advise a better means of getting information. He says he's a frequent Facebook user and notices that it is or does become an echo chamber.
Uh-huh.
Is there a better site to use instead? I guess somebody that wants to have a more wide variety of news. I mean, I'm thinking that Facebook, though, you can choose different sites to actually come into your feed.
You definitely can, but I think John is absolutely right. The holy grail of Facebook and of all, I mean, Google is not any different, right, is to keep you in an environment as long as possible. And the business model for that means I give you exactly what you want. So Facebook will record every click you've ever made, every swipe you've ever made on the tablet, every how long you've looked at articles. So they will understand you better. They understand me better than I understand myself.
Wow.
So it's in their interest to give you information that already fits your prior beliefs. What I personally do is I use a news aggregator like Feedly or like Flipbook or whatever else, and intentionally choose sources that represent both sides, right? So if there's a Wall Street Journal and a Fox News, there also needs to be a whatever the left-wing sources would be, an MSNBC and maybe The Nation. And what they do is they basically aggregate the news, and every morning you just get the whole long list of things. And as you go through, you will actually find yourself reacting more strongly to things that you disagree with and clicking on others that you do agree with. But I think that's really the way to do it, to force yourself every morning to look at all these different outlets and feed them all into one news aggregator. And I happen to use Feedly because it's free, but there are lots of others that do the exact same thing. And so to force yourself to basically go through the spinach before, you go to the French fries, meaning force yourself to read the stuff you disagree with before just consuming one more time what you already believe.
Janie in Madison called in but couldn't stay with us. She says she has used comment sections before as a way to provide feedback to media organizations because it's sometimes hard to find the correct email or phone number to do this. One request she has for NPR and for other news organizations doing this is to make sure their contact information is more readily available. She also finds it's unfortunate that she won't be able to post this feedback in comment sections. You want to talk some about that?
Yeah, having talked to, and after we did some of the studies I mentioned earlier, we really spoke to journalists all over the country and media organizations, and a lot of them were wondering about best practices. And I think a lot of journalists have found, and you know this better than I do, Joy, but a lot of journalists have found that actually engaging with readers in discussions and in some of these online discussions does help their own reporting and does help them think about issues in particular ways. To which degree that has to happen in a comment section is a different question with all the collateral negative outcomes that we talked about. But I think there's certainly, I have not heard a single journalist say hearing from my readers is not a good thing and has not helped my work. So, but there are, of course, plenty of ways of doing this as long as contact information is available. And I think Facebook, again, being a really good medium where everybody from producers of a show to the journalists themselves will be able to look at it and potentially even respond.
Yeah, well, you told me already that you see the day very soon where all news outlets will quit these website to comment sections. Do you see the day that our social media conversations are more social?
I do think we have a learning curve there, I'm in that respect. I'm an optimist, right? I mean, I do study human communication, and we've figured out ways through many, many different technologies. We've talked about how television would confine us all to our living rooms, and we wouldn't talk anymore, and to our other community members, and engage in activities outside, and so on, and then the VCR and the phone and the mobile phone and all these things. So we went through iterations of pessimism.
And we're going to have to pick up this conversation another time, as we are out of time at this time. Thanks very much for being with us. Dietram Scheufele, professor of life sciences communication at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.